Okay, welcome. Hi. Good morning. Excellent. How was the keynote this morning? Did you go? Oh, excellent. Okay. I didn't. I was working on these. I apologize. I missed it. How many of you saw Mark's talk, actually, before I get into this, just to make sure I understand where we're coming from? Okay, not too many. So, my name is Corey Sanders. I'm a Principal Program Manager Lead in the Windows Azure Fabric Controller team. And I've been working on infrastructure as a service for a while now, so I'm kind of excited to talk to you about it. As you may or may not have heard, I'm sure you've heard, as part of the keynote or as part of Mark's talk, we did just launch last Thursday. It was a hectic day, but an exciting one. It means infrastructure as a service with SQL Server. It means cross-premise connectivity, Windows Azure, I'm sorry, Windows Server Active Directory. And it also means, of course, SharePoint 2010. We added another guy in there. Linux is a part of the offer. I'm not going to spend too much time on Linux today. There's another session later tomorrow, I believe, that covers Linux and talks a lot about the Linux offering that we'll have. So today, actually, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about why, right? And then I'm going to actually go into some details on sort of how it all works underneath. And I'll explain a little bit more about that when we get there. So first of all, why? Many of you are probably saying, why not? You know, why haven't we done this yet? And so I can start off a little bit by explaining where we were before last week. And last week, we really focused on platform as a service, and we spent some time building that out, working on how to make that make the most sense for customers to write new applications. We also have, obviously, the software as a service world, which is Office 365. I won't be spending time on that. But if you look at this chart, and you look at sort of the control versus abstraction, as you move from the left to the right, you get more abstraction, which means we can take care of more for you, and cost efficiency goes up. So obviously, your localized virtualized data center has Windows Server Hyper-V or some other product, and may be running there. And then infrastructure as a service right here in the middle with the newest features. And the reason why we really wanted to spend some time on this and have spent a lot of energy building this is for existing applications, right? For these applications like SQL Server, for these applications like SharePoint, to make sure that they could work in the cloud. And so really, the effort behind infrastructure service is to make sure those applications work. It also means you do manage more of the stack, right? And for a lot of you, this is sort of second nature. A lot of that management of the stack makes sense, managing the OS, et cetera. But it is a part of that responsibility with when comes with deploying those new applications or existing applications. So the way we've sort of defined infrastructure as a service in the team, and it was sort of a culture shift for us about 2 years ago when we started thinking about this, or a year and a half ago when we started thinking about this. We started to say, well, how do we define infrastructure as a service? How do we say we've got it? And how do we say when we're ready to ship? And this was sort of the defining point. If it requires the developer to be involved, it's not infrastructure as a service. This doesn't mean config. It doesn't mean setting things up. It means a developer. And so a great example that we sort of hit very early in our development cycle, we were testing with the Active Directory team, which is one of our major applications that we wanted to make sure worked. And they were testing on the platform and making sure things worked. Turns out Active Directory actually uses fragmented UDP, which we had no idea. And our networking system just didn't work with fragmented UDP. So we were looking at it. We were debugging it. And unfortunately, at that point, we were still fairly junior in the infrastructure as a service world in Windows Azure. We had a few of the developers on the team say, well, can't they just change their app? And of course, we said, well, no, it's Active Directory. They can't just change their app. It's Windows. And so it took a little bit of this learning to get people to think, oh, right, that can't be asked anymore. We can't say, can't you just change your app anymore? We have to say, oh, how do we change to make this work? And so when I think about what this offers, I tried to come up with the best analogy I could. So this one may or may not work. I'll actually ask for a vote at the end. So when I look at sort of what we offer, infrastructure as a service, while very exciting, and I've been working on it for quite a long time, it's in some ways boring in that all it does is sort of provide a mechanism for other things to happen, right? And so the way I thought about it was infrastructure service is really like a road, right? A road by itself is kind of uninteresting, right? What are you going to do on a road, right? It's not until you actually get a car on there, and the car may or may not look dopey and animated like that. Before you get a car on there, a road's not that interesting. You can spend years and years working on a road, but until you get a car on there, it's meaningless. And that car, for me, is the application, right? And so when we really looked at infrastructure as a service, we said, let's get the application going. Let's get the application driving on the road and get them on the cloud superhighway. Okay, not a great analogy. Anyway, I'm moving on. So let me show you just quickly what I mean. Okay, and just a super fast one, just to sort of show you. So as a quick point, this is a 200-level session. I will be digging into a little bit of the 300-level content as well. I hope that's okay. If it's not, well, I guess you can leave. I don't know. I'll do a little bit of both. I apologize. Mark covered a lot of the 200 content yesterday. So, okay. Fast VM creation. So what I want to show you just really fast is, again, this concept of how quickly you can get started here. And I'm starting in PowerShell. A lot of the other demos have started in Portal. I'll do a little bit of both today. So if you look right now, what I'm doing here is I'm actually spinning up a VM. And my point about it being an application, the VM that I'm spinning up is actually a SQL VM. Okay? And so I get out of here, and just as simple as that, I hit go. It's going to create. Oh, it's going to actually fail. Sorry about that. Wow, my Big Bang demo at the beginning. Sorry. Let me just do that. I was testing the demo right before, and then, of course, it left something behind. So you just quickly get started. You spin up immediately spin up a virtual machine. And after this goes and boots, I'll have a SQL Server machine ready to go use. I'll come back and play with that a little bit later. So let me tell you a little bit about what we're going to talk about. First, we'll spend some time talking about applications and work with a question mark. I will talk about the applications that we've really focused on, and we've made sure and we validated with those teams. I'm also going to talk about a few things we know don't work, and just make sure you're aware of those. Then I'm going to spend some time talking about the magic of provisioning. I put that in quotes since it's sysprep, so I'll spend just a few minutes talking about how that works and sort of what we're doing there behind the scenes so that you're able to use it most effectively to build your applications. Then I'll talk about VHDs are cool. That's actually our underlying storage system, and our underlying mechanism for moving things around is all just VHDs. So they are cool. Then I'll spend just a few minutes on dev test and sort of how to manage that, and then I'll add some complexity right at the end. And then I'll leave some time for questions, hopefully, depending on where we are with the time. Okay. So moving forward here. So applications and not infrastructure, as I mentioned. So when I say it's all about the app, there are three big ones. These are the three we really spent the most time working on. They're SQL Server, Windows Server Active Directory, and of course SharePoint 2010. So we did focus on versions. We spent a lot of time with these teams picking the right versions based on where we thought market share made sense and also based on what was actually supported on a virtualized system. So for SQL Server, of course, we support SQL Server 2008, 2008 R2, and 2012. Active Directory is just the Windows versions, 2008 R2 and 2012. It's RC at this point. And then SharePoint will be SharePoint 2010. This will also move forward. Right, so as new releases come out, we will support those new releases. We're unlikely to move back unless there's sort of an uproar in this room and you riot. I think we take some of that feedback and go look backwards. But at this point, we're sort of in a forward-looking path. And so when you sort of say, why versions? Why are you limiting versions? Right, infrastructure as a service is supposed to be just about giving me a virtual machine and letting me do with it what I will. Well, we effectively do that. Right, we do just give you a virtual machine and you can do with it really what you will. But from a supported statement, we want to make sure we give you the very best possibilities and very best support story you can get. So what this means is we want to make sure these applications and Windows Azure are better together. So that means SharePoint is better with Windows Azure than any other cloud provider. SQL Server is better with Windows Azure than any other cloud provider. And it has to be that way. They're down the street from us, right? It's really inexcusable for it not to be that way. Better together means it's better be better, right? It's kind of a mouthful. Looks better on the slide than it sounds. What this means is we really need to validate it. We really need to make sure it works. We really need to make sure we work with these teams and that they're validating it. In fact, the three teams that I just mentioned, each one of them validated on Windows Azure, and the Windows Azure team just gave them VMs. It also means that these are fully supported and tested. So you call into the SharePoint team, and they're ready to support on top of Windows Azure. You call in the SQL support team, and they're ready to support on top of Windows Azure. They've all been trained, and they all know what to do. So this is really why we limit the versions, so that we make sure those versions are fantastic. Excellent. So the gallery. Just to kind of give you a feel for what is available in the gallery. These are the things that you can go just download without uploading anything. And so Windows Server 2008 R2, SQL Server 2012 Eval, and Windows Server 2012 RC. This is preview. We'll likely have more as we move into the general availability. And then, of course, Linux, OpenSUSE, CentOS, Ubuntu, and SUSE Linux Enterprise Server. Again, I'm not going to spend much time on Linux today. There is a whole other session dedicated to it. Okay. So I promised things that not supported. In some ways, this is probably more interesting to you. So I specifically focused on OS components at this point and ones that we know don't work, and I'll explain why. So Hyper-V obviously doesn't work on Hyper-V. You can't run sort of a nested Hyper-V solution. So that doesn't work. If you try and click that on, it will fail. DHCP and NLB both don't work. NLB is a network load balancer. These both require broadcast, which isn't supported in our network. And so you should not try and turn these on. They will not work. Failover clustering, this is an interesting one. So failover clustering requires a floating IP to move with it. It does not, we do not have the support for that today. We are aggressively working on this support. And so hopefully we'll have more to announce maybe later this year. But yeah, failover clustering is a tough one because of that network requirement as well. And then of course BitLocker on the OS disk has a requirement for a TPM chip to be able to encrypt that. And so BitLocker on the OS disk will not work. Okay. So what about licensing? It's kind of the third rail around, well, in Microsoft at least. So don't quote me that I said that. I'll be in a lot of trouble. Okay, so licensing. Windows, you're probably all tweeting or whatever quickly. Okay, Windows Server. So this is a per-hour license in the cloud. So you do not bring your Windows Server license with you. So even if you're uploading, even if you're copying and moving things, that license does not move. The license stays with it on premises. However, application license does have mobility specifically for software assurance. And so this is things like SharePoint. This is things like SQL. That license can move to the cloud. One important point there, that doesn't mean that the VHD has to move. You don't have to move a SharePoint VHD from on-premise to the cloud to take advantage of that license. You can install it in the cloud and you can take advantage of it there. And then, of course, external licensing. This is really based on the vendor and product. We are working with a bunch of vendors and products to make sure that they will support at some point in the future. I don't have the list with me right now, but this is something that as you sort of look at what applications you want to go put up there, you want to go talk with that vendor and that specifically about that product and see whether it's supported or not. Okay. So let me spend some time talking to you about sort of how provisioning works. But first, let me just tell you there's a few ways to sort of get into the platform. There's the management portal, which is the pretty UI that you've seen in a few demos. It's HTML, so it should work on all devices. That's the goal. There's scripting, which I'll show you as well. This is sort of your PowerShell solution that allows you to script directly in and build applications based on that scripting or build deployment mechanisms based on that scripting. And then, of course, there's just the REST API, which is sort of the underlying layer. In fact, the REST API that we've exposed, both the management portal and scripting call directly into it. There's no special APIs that these guys get. So the REST API is kind of the bottom line, but all of them end up working, hopefully. So let me tell you about provisioning, and then I'll show you it in the demo. So to provision, this is getting started. And if you're starting with a gallery image, it means that we're supplying that initial image. But you're supplying the details. You're supplying what's going to be set as the host name. You're supplying what the admin password is going to be. You may even be supplying the AD credentials as part of that initial virtual machine to start. So when you supply that in through the API or through the portal or through the REST interface, what we end up doing is actually creating an ISO. So we'll create a CD, a DVD, and we'll store it with an unattend file on it. How many are familiar with sysprep in the room? Okay. More people familiar with sysprep than saw Mark's talk. I like that. It's good for me. No, I don't like that, actually. Mark, is Mark here? No. Okay. It's good for me. Okay. So to get started, you're copying from our repository. So we handle this. We have a repository of these stock images, right? So you saw, you know, the Windows, the SQL, the Windows Server 2012. So these are just stored by us. And when you say provision, it'll copy over one of those images into your account. So you'll just see a VHD pop up when you call this command into your account. We'll then lock them. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what this lock means. It's actually called leasing, and it's sort of a protection against you making a mistake by accident. So we'll spin up the VM. I'll talk a little bit more about the cache, but we put sort of a local disk that we put the paging file on. Then we connect the OS, obviously directly back to the OS disk that we just copied in. We connect any data disks that you've asked for. And then we connect this ISO. And the ISO is, of course, that has that unattend file on it, so that when we boot, Windows Setup finds that unattend file on that ISO and starts Windows Setup with that unattend. That unattend also has on it an agent that will do a few things, but a lot of the capabilities and things that we set up there, like Active Directory setup, like username, like password, all of that's just a part of the unattend file as part of sysprep, as you know and maybe love or hate, I don't know. So that's kind of the process. Let me actually walk through it here on the portal, and I can show you what I mean. Okay, so I've got the portal up and running here. Let's see here. Okay. So if I go in here and I say create a virtual machine, and I'll go from gallery, since I like to see the logos, most of the logos. And I'll go ahead and say, let's do 2012 RC. And so here you see I'm entering the virtual machine name. So this is, of course, going to go straight into that unattend file of what that host name should be. Actually. Okay, and then, of course, the administrator password. And you see that administrator, hopefully you can see that, administrator is grayed out here because it forces you to actually select administrator. That is a limitation of Windows Setup. And it's something that we are looking at. Maybe we add an agent that does more there. On the Linux side, you actually can put in your username. And so that's one of the kind of one of the differences there. Okay. Then, of course, this is less of the Windows Setup side and more of the the actual Windows Azure side. And so you pick whatever your DNS name that you may want to expose for this VM. You can close down all those ports if you want to. But this is just you'll get a DNS name associated with that VM. Okay, I'll pick a storage account that I want to use. It's going to go to West US. Okay. And then I'll get going with it. Okay. So, as that gets going, let me actually slide over here. So while that's getting started, there's a couple other paths that are worth pointing out. So that provisioning story was when we supplied the image. So you went to the gallery and you said, here's one of the pre-canned images that we want, and it was listed from our list. You can also upload. You can also capture. And I'm actually not going to walk through the capture process today. That is in a session later today or tomorrow from Vijay R. But I will show you a little bit about how that works underneath. And again, it's the same exact process, and this is why it's worth pointing this out. Capture ends up taking that OS disk that you were running, you've sysprepped it, you shut it down, and then we just copy it back as an image. Really, capture is somewhat of a glorified copy. It ends up just taking whatever you've done that you've sysprepped and puts it back into your own repository as an image that then you can reboot and go through that provisioning pipeline. The reason why we use sysprep with all its sort of pros and flaws is the fact that it makes it super easy for you guys to go build your own. Because you understand sysprep, you understand how it works, you understand in the ways it doesn't work, right? And so this is why when we do capture and you hit that capture button, it really is just a glorified copy. Same thing with upload, right? And so if you're uploading, you've copied this into your account. If you've sysprepped it, it's just an image, right? And so then when you're reprovisioning, it's the exact same process. The only process that's different is, of course, it's coming from your account. So you hit add server, hostname, password, turns into an ISO, same jazz here. But then the copy is from your own account instead of from our account because this is the image that you've created. Otherwise, it's all the same. It goes through, boots, sets everything up, sets up the ISO, and you're good to go. So let me just quickly show this. Let's see here. So, and I'll just show you what I mean here. So, and I'm not going to actually provision this one, but if you go from gallery, and if you've uploaded one using CS Upload, which is the tool that Vijay will show in his talk, you may have an uploaded image here. And this, again, VHD, I created on-premises, set it up, ran sysprep, now I can go do this. And you see I can click through and I can go provision it however I want to. Add my own machine name, add my own password, just like you saw from the other one. Similarly, one that I've captured is also there, and the same sort of process holds. Right? I can walk through it, I can click through it, let's see here. And I can go ahead and supply my own machine name and so on. So I'm not going to actually do this right now. But what I do want to show you quickly is the process that maybe if you've built an image that you like and you want to share with someone else, you can also just copy these things and reprovision them somewhere else. And so let me quickly show you what I mean. Okay? So here's the captured image. We actually supply it with a random name. It's something that actually I think we need to improve. That's a little bit confusing to see that name. But you can also then, of course, just copy it. And so this is that captured image that I showed you. It just has Windows Server 2012 on it. I'm sorry, Windows Server 2008 R2. And so what I've done here is you can take this and you can say, okay, I really like this image that I uploaded. I want my friend to use it. Right? I want the guy down the hall to start using it in his account. So you can very easily just say, okay, let's copy this guy. Let's put him into backup. And of course, because this is Windows Azure Storage, it's an instantaneous copy. It's a shadow copy. And so I've just copied a full OSVHD. And I'm going to rename it to copied image. Okay? Now let's say I move this over to my friend's account, which happens to be right here. Okay? And so from there, I've now copied an image. Let me actually go in to the portal now and say, okay, so I've got this copied image. Let me go find it. So my portal account. Okay, so there it is. So now what I've done here is I've gone to the image tab and I've hit create image. And so I'm going to go pull in this image that's in my storage account that's just sitting there. It's not a part of my account yet, a part of my portal account yet. And I'll just say, okay, yeah, let's go open this. And let's call this guy copied. Great. And then, of course, I'll say, yes, Windows image has been sysprepped. This is more of just a heads up to make sure I know what I'm doing. Okay. And so that copied image, this is really just a reference to make sure now I can use it as part of my account. And so then from there, let me go over to PowerShell and sort of show you. So you'll see here what I've done is, let me zoom in here so you can see it. So here I've created an image variable. Actually, let me start quickly by showing you just the start of PowerShell. So obviously, I'm importing the module for PowerShell. You can find all these details. But you can also import the Azure Publish file settings. And so there's a few steps of how to walk through this. But you can end up downloading your settings for Azure, and then you can import them everywhere you go. So I've downloaded them already for all my account settings here to a local directory. And so I run this every time I get started. So here I see image is copied image, right? And that's the one I just imported. And of course, the media location, what this is going to be what I create as part of deploying, right? So I can basically say, I've got this image. I know a part of the image process is going to be copying it into my account for a disk that I'm going to start booting from, right? So this is the name of that disk that I want to go use. And so this will create that for me when I boot it. And of course, instance size, small, image name, media location, those are the variables that I just supplied. And let me just call it Corey copied image. Okay, let me double check that it's done. Yep, so it has been referenced in there. Okay. Okay, great. And so it's creating the deployment right now with that copied image that I just pulled in. So let me actually go over here and refresh. And there you see the copied disk is already there. So you see, well, let me zoom in here. You see that this just got created. So as part of this provisioning process, I've taken this image that I've uploaded or that I've captured previously, and this will copy it into my same storage account based on the location that I've said, right? And then it will end up booting from this. So my image remains untouched, and this becomes where I'm booting from directly. Okay. Excellent. All right, and there it goes. It should be booting up now. All right, let me zoom back over. Okay. So, what should you avoid? Well, these are some of the typical gotchas that you've got with sysprep. First of all, you do have to sysprep it, and it needs to be generalized for it to work through this image process. I'll show you sort of the process that you need to use if you're not going to do this. Do not put an unattend on the disk. This will bypass our unattend, right? So if you put an unattend in your, you know, Panther directory or System32 directory, it actually has precedent over the one that we put on the ISO, and it'll bypass it. So that will cause the provisioning to time out and fail and so on because it doesn't call into ours. If you're familiar with the current VM role, unfamiliarize yourself with it. Do not install the Windows Azure integration components. This will also override the unattend solution. So if you're not familiar with VMroll, ignore this point, the existing one. If you are, read this point. Okay. And here's kind of an interesting one. Because we're using sysprep and because we're using Windows Setup, there's actually no agent required. Right? So there is no Windows Azure agent that you have to install or prepare as part of this process. So if you already have 20, hundreds, whatever, sysprepped VHDs that you're ready to just use, you can upload those and they'll work. Right? We don't have to actually have any sort of agent put down because we use Windows Setup. That is our agent. And I have the little picture here of this sysprep tool. Okay. So let me just spend a couple of minutes explaining a little bit more about images and then also disks. So what will work? We feel pretty good about sysprep working. Sysprep does a lot of interesting, important stuff about cleaning out things like your network settings and so on. We believe that if you just take a sysprepped image and upload it, it should all just work. Disk. Now, this is the actual running instance. This is something that's already been specialized. This is something that's running actively. For this, it will work most of the time, right? I think it's something that you need to think through about sort of what you're doing on that disk. Sysprep does a lot of the nice cleanup that when you just take a VHD and move it. Obviously, Windows doesn't technically support that when you're moving from one machine to another. So it's one of those things to be cautious of and be aware. I think if you're moving it locally from one Hyper-V to another Hyper-V, you'll sort of see the same problems. But it's something to be conscious of and be aware of when you're moving these images, or disks, excuse me. But booting a disk is pretty simple. There's no provisioning details. You're just saying, here's my disk, boot it, please. And we just connect it up. And we boot it. And let me just quickly show you that. So let me go over here and take a look at my virtual machines now. And you can see that copied image is provisioning right now. So if you take one of these Windows 8 boxes, Windows Server, I'm sorry, ooh, don't quote me, Windows Server 2012 boxes, and you click on them, you can see where they're located in storage. Okay, and so this one's located here in Cori storage. So I'm going to go over there and take one of these. Let's take VM1. And so again, simple sort of copy. This is a running VHD, so it's not a clean shutdown. I would not advise doing this on sort of a regular basis, but for demo purposes. So, and then I can move it over here to my disks and go ahead and paste. And I'll rename it here. Okay, great. And then what I can do, just even through the portal I can do this. Oh, sorry, missed a step. Once you've copied that in, now you have a disk that you need to import. And so you go into Create Disk. Oops, wrong one. And there you'll see my copied Windows 2012 disk. Pull that in. This does contain an operating system, so I'll click that box, and it's Windows. And I'll pull that in. Let me get rid of this previous success here. Okay, and this is relatively instantaneous here. And so again, this is just creating a reference, right? So I have it in Windows Azure Storage. It's a VHD just running there. This is creating a reference to it through the portal, through the API system, so that now I can boot from it. see here. All right, great, there it is. So it's up. And now, just as simple as that, I can go in my disks, and you see there's my copied one. It's the VHD that I copied over here. Make it a small. And you'll see that I can't put in password, I can't put in the host name, none of that can be supplied here, right? This is just a running VHD that I'm just booting again, right? So all that's already been defined. And so here I can say, okay, let's do, that looks good. And then of course I'll boot. Great, and that'll just boot up. Okay, let's go back to the slides and I can show you a few more hopefully fun things. Okay. So that's what I kind of wanted to cover about the provisioning system. Just to kind of give a recap, the provisioning system for Windows really uses sysprep. That's the focus. That's how it works. You can just boot disks, and they just power up, which means you can't supply any provisioning information. You can't supply admin password. They just start, right? So those are kind of two different solutions. They apply for different needs. There are a lot of applications that just don't work through sysprep, which you're probably well aware of, painfully aware of probably. Sysprep happens to be one of them. And so for those, you'll either install them in the cloud on an already provisioned instance, or you will upload as part of that disk. Okay. So now I want to spend a little bit of time talking to you about how the underlying VHD and Windows Azure storage system works. I think it's important. I'll talk about caching and sort of how you may want to configure things to make sure your applications are going to work really well. So first, I wanted to just show the power of VHD mobility. For VHD mobility, the nice thing about this all being this file format that's just known and well-defined and what hopefully some people use or can at least convert via, it means you can move these virtual machines or these VHDs and then start virtual machines between your data center and Windows Azure. It also means you can do some interesting things between Windows Azure and other providers, whether public or private cloud. You can also move between those. And allows this mobility really allows a lot of flexibility with what you're going to do. So when we say VM with persistent drive, what does that mean? Well, it means the OS disk is actually in Windows Azure Storage. Windows Azure Storage is triplicate copy, which is high durability. So it means any one of these disks dies, and it actually will restart, and you'll never notice it. It's just running as part of a virtual machine. You don't even know if the disks are dying underneath behind you. It also means we have automatic geo-replicated storage. So it means anything that goes into this disk will be geo-replicated greater than 400 miles. So a great example is a West and an East DC. We do make sure they're over 400 miles for that replication, and it's continuous. So it's continuously replicating across. It is lazy, so it is not going to be sort of instantaneous writes. The triplicate copies are instantaneous, so you won't get a response back that the write happened until the triplicate copies are done. But the geo-replication will take some time. So when we say persistent, what does this really mean? What's different about this than what we used to have? Well, what it really means is because it's in Windows Azure Storage, if that virtual machine were to die, or that hardware that virtual machine's on were to die, which does happen, this is commodity hardware, we actually spin it back up and reboot from those same disks, and the disks are not gone. They're still sitting in Windows Azure Storage untouched. It will look like a hard reboot, right? Obviously, the hardware has died. But the machine will continue running, and it is saved back on Windows Azure Storage. It also gives you that flexibility that I talked about with moving these VHDs around. So that's really, when we say persistent, what we mean. It means stored off box. It means you're not relying on the commodity hardware to stay alive for your data and for your running OS to stay alive. So it's worth spending just a couple minutes explaining the layout when you actually get into one of these instances. So this is Windows Server 2012 RC. And if you boot into it and you sort of pull up the disk view, disk 0 on LUN 0 is your persistent OS disk. This is going to be drive C. The default cache is read-write. I'll explain the cache here in a few slides. This will be a SATA drive. Okay. And it will show up as drive C. It will look like the Windows. It will have the nice Windows logo on it. And it will sit there. Cool. Second drive. So this is actually a local drive. This is very important to sort of point out. This is not persistent. We debated a lot about sort of what to do with this drive. We debated whether we should put it at all. The main reason why it's there, frankly, is for the paging file. So the paging file will default to this location. when you run through SysPrep, it automatically puts it on there. It really, you can use it. You'll have variable space based on whatever VM size you use, but you should be very aware that this is temporary. It's also local, which means you are limited by the speed of those local disks instead of the speed of Windows Azure Storage. And it will always be drive D, because it's also SATA, which means it comes in right after the OS drive. So that's worth pointing out. You can change the drives. Actually, our IT department went through and changed all their drives because they wanted drive D to be the application drive. And so you can do that. We've actually got a lot of feedback that we shouldn't be using drive D for this, and it's something that I think we're going to look at. By some nodding, I think it was we went the wrong way, but we'll fix it. Anyway, so this is drive D right now. And then the final point is any data disk that you add from there will have whatever drive letter you give them when they come in. At this point, I've got drive in the LUN 2, and it will be SCSI from then on. So any data disk that you add from there out will be SCSI. They are persistent. They default to no cache. And of course, it's your own defined drive letter. So quickly, and this is, of course, I gave this drive F and 800 gig. Okay, quickly walking through. You can, for 2008 R2, it's the same sort of picture, right? You've got drive C, you've got drive D, which is your temporary storage, and of course, your larger data disks for your customer-defined drive later down. Okay. So when you add a blank disk, this is also important because they don't just pop up as a drive. They're not formatted. So when you go through adding a blank disk, it will just show up as part of your hardware list, but it will not be formatted. Right? So you have to go in and actually format this guy. It will be auto-onlined. So we have set the setting as part of provision to turn the disk on immediately, but it will not be formatted. It will not be initialized. So you'll end up needing to have to go through this process for each one of these disks only once, and then once you add them back, they'll come back. So you can go through the initializing and, of course, the formatting steps. And then you can use, copy, download, do with it what you will. All right, let me show you a few examples of this. Okay. All right, all my virtual machines are up. That's cool. Okay, so let me go take one of these images, this SQL Server guy that I started here at the beginning. Let me go ahead and add. And so you'll see right now what I'm doing is I clicked on the image, the running VM, sorry. And I can just say attach disk. Oops. Sorry, I want to attach a blank one. I'll attach an empty disk. Let's say I want it to be 500 gig. And why don't I call it SQL Data Disk? Okay. And that'll just attach that disk, and we'll take a look at it here when we get in a minute. The other thing I want to show you is actually attaching a non-blank disk, a running disk. So let me go in here, and I happen to have... So what you see here, again, through PowerShell, I have VM1, so I'm going to be attaching this to Windows 2012 VM1. I'm going to attach a large data disk, which is one that I've pre-created to show you. And it's the service name here is Server 2012 Demo. And you can see here, through the PowerShell commands, I'm just getting the Azure VM, adding the data disk, and then updating it. And you see through the PowerShell, I am selecting LUN 2. I can select whatever LUN I want to, up to 16. Let me just run this. Okay, great. And just as a quick point, you can have up to 16 data disks on an extra large. They go down in half by size. So you go down to large, you can have 8, medium, 4, et cetera. You can divide by 2 down. Extra small is 1. Okay. So while that's coming up, let me actually go in here. And I think I added it to Server 2012 VM1. I'll go ahead and connect to it. And while I'm connecting to that, I'll also connect to the SQL Server VM. And so while these are connecting, what I'm actually going to show here is the difference between a disk that I previously formatted versus a disk that I've not formatted, and sort of how they show up into these two machines, which seem to be connecting pretty slowly here. Okay. Just make sure that that script did finish. Okay. A little bit slower connection than I expected. Oh. Well, the attached disk worked. These are deployed US West, so maybe that was my problem here. There we go. All right. Of course, they'll both come in at the same time. So here I have the Windows Server 2012 machine, and you see it took so long for me to actually connect that I've already got the disk attached, right? And so this was the disk that I just attached to it, the large data disk, and he's up and running, and I can just connect to it. He's sitting there. And of course, if I were to detach him, and this is all just hot. It's all hot adding. So because these are SCSI disks, I can plug them in and out, and you can just do it through the portal without shutting down your machine. So let me go back here, and I can say, yeah, let's go ahead and detach this disk now that I just detached. And so let me show you on this side the difference here. So I pull this guy up, and this is the one where I added the blank disk. And I've got nothing. But if I go and I pull up computer management, and click on disk management, you'll see, oh, it immediately popped up and said, hey, you've got a disk here, what do you want to do with it? So I can select that, and of course now he's up, he's online, he's now been initialized, I can create a simple volume, do with it what I will. Great, and you saw here on the left, it just happened. On the left, the disk just went away. So now I can move that disk somewhere else if I wanted to, whatever I want to do. Great. Okay, let's see here. Let me switch back over to the slides and keep walking forward. Okay. Oh, they're up there. They're not here. All right, great. So let me just spend a couple seconds here talking a little bit about Windows Azure Storage and sort of what makes it a little bit different from a typical land-based system. So a couple quick points here about sort of how this is set up. When you're booting from a VM here, the host OS takes a bunch of the disk space on the local disk for whatever it needs to do. Temporary storage, that's the one I showed you. That's, of course, also on the local disk. And then your OS and data disk may be on this land-based storage with, of course, other guys sharing on it. When you look at Windows Azure Storage and sort of what makes it different, of course, it's scale. Windows Azure Storage is just really big. It means that there's a lot less likely that you're going to have a noisy neighbor just because of how big and how massive the system is. But on top of that, Windows Azure Storage actually does automatic load balancing. Right? So when you end up seeing your disk getting hot, it'll end up splitting you out and making sure that you're separated across different disks throughout all of Windows Azure Storage. Right? And so that load balancing really helps make sure that you can maintain the highest level of IOPS that you ever want to get, and lowest level of latency, of course, as well. So your OS and data disks are out there on Windows Azure Storage. So let me spend just 2 minutes on the caches, just to make sure that it's clear sort of what these are. They're a little bit bizarre in some ways, so let me outline exactly what they do. So with the read cache, this is actually, think of it as sort of a disk cache, right? So when you think of sort of you're setting up your disks and you have a cache set with your disk, it's sort of that driver cache, right? So when you have a read cache turned on, it means on the local host-managed disk, we'll put some portion of your reads there. If it's there, great. If it's not, of course, we miss and we go out to Windows Azure Storage and pull it in, okay? So that's just sitting on that local disk. A write cache, I'm sorry, and then writes, of course, obviously go to both locations to make sure that we do get the read cache updated. For a write cache, we actually store the reads of the same process, but we actually store the writes, again, in sort of local memory. So we take a small chunk of those writes, and we'll start accumulating them. And then after a period of time, we'll flush that out. So you can see why on data disks we turn write caches and read caches off by default. Right? We want to make sure that the data is updated, is write through, so it's updated immediately. right? But then on the OS disk, we have it on because this helps boot really, really fast. So it's something to keep in mind. And then, of course, no cache just means reads and writes are all going straight to storage and, of course, coming back. And you don't get a response back until they've gone all the way around trip. Okay. So let me just quickly give you the disk wrap sheet here. One, the OS disk, the maximum size is 127 gigabytes. The reason why we picked 127 gigabytes is because that's actually the maximum size that's defaulted to when you create a VHD through Hyper-V. We probably will grow this over time. It's something that we wanted to start off with and sort of see how it went through the preview. The data disks, on the other hand, are only limited by the size of the Windows Azure Storage blob, which is 1 terabyte. So you can have 1 terabyte disks, and you can have up to 16 on extra large. For the cache, you can only have 4. So only 4 of your disks can have a cache. The reason why we did that is because we are limited by the hardware on the local box. And so we didn't want you to get yourself into a situation where you try and cache more than actually the local hardware will make sense for you. And thus, we only limit it. Our recommendation, actually, for data disks is just to turn the cache off, frankly. The only cache that makes the most sense is going to be on the OS disk right now. OK, so when I show you that, let me actually quickly show you what just a very fast PowerShell example of how to do this. And again, this is just I'm spinning up a VM here. And you can see set Azure OS disk right here. And I can go ahead and set the cache to be read-only. And this is setting the cache on that OS disk. Okay. And then I can just run it. And that'll deploy a virtual machine. Changing the cache will reboot your VM. So if you've already deployed and you want to change it, it will result in a reboot. Excellent. All right. Let me slide back over here. All right, let me touch quickly upon the pricing model. The reason why I call out specifically storage pricing model is because you do pay for transactions, which can catch you a little bit off guard, perhaps, based on what you may expect from running this locally. We did just dramatically reduce the price of transactions, actually, by about a 90% cost reduction. So it's at least a lot cheaper. So 1 million transactions is about is a dime. To put this into sort of perspective, it takes about 15,000 to boot Windows. And it takes about, Windows runs about 9 or 10 transactions a second. So it takes a lot for this to actually become a dominating part of your cost. However, if you're running sort of a very pressing SQL server for a long, long period of time, it can add up. So it is something to keep in mind, but it is it does take a while for just Windows running for this to become any real substantial cost. Storage space, 100 gig is $12.50 a month. So this also gives you a lot of room to move. And then, of course, usage. You pay for only what you use. So what does that mean? So when you make a disk, let's say that blank disk that I created that was, what, 500 gig? I'm only paying for what part of that I've used. So actually, right now, I've used very, very little of it. I'm probably going to pay for less than a gig of that disk, even though it's sitting there as a 500 gig disk. Once I fill it up, I'll start paying for that full amount. There is an important caveat here, though, which is that there's no real trim functionality. So once you fill up a full disk, now you're paying for it, right? And so it's something to keep in mind as you're using the system that when you haven't yet filled it up, you're not paying for it, which is fantastic. We don't yet have trim functionality through the OS, which means once you fill it up all the way, now you're paying for it, even if you've gone and deleted it, because there's no way to sort of zero that data back out. That is something that we are working on as well. Okay. And now there's one quick point about sort of how you're managing these disks. These disks are, of course, stored in Windows Azure Storage, right? They're just VHDs there. You can move them around. You can copy them. But they're also leased by the platform as part of making sure that you don't sort of kill yourself and delete something that's in use or whatever it may be. So when the VM is created, the VHD is locked. When in the library, the VHD is locked. To completely delete something, you first need to go unlease it, right, which is delete through the portal or delete through the API, and then go back into storage. I'm going to walk you through this because it's a little bit confusing. So you see here I have my disks, and this VM1 happens to be running. I know that this is a booting OS, right? So deleting it would be really bad. It would blue screen. It would not be happy. So go ahead and hit delete. And there you see, it could not delete. First of all, it says there's currently a lease against it. Here's an important point. Do you wish to continue? This lease is owned by me, right? So while the platform's using it, I still own this VHD. I could hit yes, and then it would blue screen, and it would terrible things would happen. Well, I mean, it would just break the lease, and no more rights would go to it. So this is still my lease. It's really for my own good, but this is the protection we put in place to make sure you're not accidentally fat finger and delete a VHD and say, oh, no, my VM just blue screened. It's sort of to put that protection in place. But you'll also see small data disk, which is not actually mounted anywhere. And so I'll pull this up here and say, here are my disks. And so you see small data disk here. It's not attached to anything. It's just sitting in my account ready to be used. Over here, if I say delete on this guy, I'll get that same lease error. It's not being used by anything, but it's still being leased by the platform so that I can use it if I need to. Right? And so to actually make that delete work, I need to go through the platform, and then I need to say delete. And so we have to change some of this terminology a little bit, I think. This is technically not deleting it in Windows Azure Storage. It's simply deleting it or removing the lease from it in the platform. And then Windows Azure Storage, the VHD, will still be there. The goal was to be able to allow you to go still make copies of it and remount it and move it around. But it turns out I think there's going to be, it's worth explaining that to make sure you're not confused. Since I'm confused by that. So, okay. don't quote me. I'm in big trouble when I leave this talk. Okay. So now I go to small data disk, and you see I can now hit delete. There's no lease, and it just goes away, right? And so that is sort of the process. Now I've deleted that, and I'm not using it anymore. Okay. Great. Okay, cool. Let me slide back over here. Okay. So I wanted to spend just a few minutes on dev test and sort of how to make that work really, really well. So first, when you walk through the dev test experience, the goal is to be able to store those VHDs in Windows Azure Storage but not be paying for a virtual machine running from it, right? That's kind of an important goal to try and live up to when you're building your dev test environment. So the way to accomplish this is actually to remove your virtual machine. Right, so the Windows Azure Storage rights are still there. They're still back in Windows Azure Storage. But you can delete that virtual machine, and you can always spin it back up later, and it will start back up from those same disks that we're running from before. Right, so the best way to sort of accomplish a very simplistic dev test environment is to just say delete your virtual machine and come back later from those same disks that you were booting from. The one complication with that we do have is the fact that if you had endpoints associated with it or you had data disks associated with it, as I do in this guy, so I have data disk associated with it, and I may have endpoints, those are not necessarily preserved when you're going and deleting your VM and recreating it. So what we've actually done through PowerShell is the ability to sort of import-export all those capabilities. Right? And so let me show you quickly what I mean. And what this does is that with PowerShell, you'll be able to put that onto an XML file and be able to redeploy that XML file anytime you want for a quick dev test experience. So this is sort of what it looks like. This is the only PowerShell I show on the slides, and I'll walk through it. But when you're running a virtual machine and you're like, hey, I want to save this aside, you know, I want to go start this later, I'll go export the VM. So you export it, we'll copy aside the data disks, we'll copy aside the endpoints, we'll put it into this location that you put. And then you can remove that VM with no problem and come back later and import it, and you should be ready to go. I'll wait for the picture. Okay. And then when you import it, of course, you supply the same XML. You supply sort of the location and wherever you want to deploy it, and you can redeploy it. Okay. I want to show that at the demo here quickly. This is only through PowerShell right now. Okay. So I actually have this saved aside. I can go pull it up. And so this is a VM that I started up earlier. It has endpoints set up. It has a hard disk, a data disk attached to it already that I have in my account, and it has the role size already set up. So with this, I can now, again, as I show here, I can use import and be able to pick my location and the name and go ahead and go. And that should just start up for me. And so that'll start up exactly the way I left it. And this creates a really nice sort of dev test experience, right? You spin something up, you play with it, you then can wipe it away, come back later, and you don't pay in the interim. All right. Let me go back here. Okay. So let me add just a little bit of complexity. So the question comes up, okay, great, I've got this virtual machine. I can run with it. I'm excited. I can use it. Fantastic. How do I group my virtual machines? And what do I get from grouping my virtual machines? This is a point that's come up in a few talks. Mark talked a little bit about it. It's a little bit of a tricky concept, but it gives you a lot of power. So when you spin up a single virtual machine, we call it a standalone virtual machine. It sits in your account on the list that I showed you with virtual machines listed out that way. However, when you go through the process and spin up a second one and say that you want to connect the two, and there's one of the buttons through the setup of provisioning, you can say connect this to an existing virtual machine or to an existing cloud service. This will then put these guys into sort of what we're calling this local network situation. And we call this now a cloud service. So what power does this get me? Well, there's a few big things that this gets you. It allows you to do load balancing. So once you put these guys together into the same service, they now can be load balanced, and you can control the probe. And there's a session later that spends a lot of time on this. You can also get high availability. So now you can define, and I'll show you a picture of this, availability sets that span these machines so that you can get higher availability. You get automated subnet connectivity. So what I mean by this is each instance has a 10.star address range. These things are now open to each other. They're protected from other people who are not in that cloud service, but when they're in the same cloud service, they're just open and they can talk. It simplifies this networking construct quite a bit. And then it also gives you automated Azure-provided DNS. So these machines now, without you deploying a DNS server, they can now talk to each other. They can talk to each other just by using their machine name. And I'll show you a quick demo of that. So just to go into a little bit of detail here, these are covered in much more detail in other talks, so I'm not going to spend too much time on them. The availability set, what this really means is that we're spanning a single point of failure. So you say, I have my SQL 1, my SQL mirror, and my SQL witness all in one availability set. It means we'll span single points of failure automatically. So they won't be on the same physical machine, and they won't actually even be on the same rack, because the top of rack switch and the power distribution unit are single points that could go. So we span them across those racks, as you can see sort of by this picture, when you define that availability set. Likewise, now you can also do load balancing, and these typically go hand in hand. So if you're building a SharePoint farm, your front ends, you'll want them in an availability set, and you'll also want them load balanced to make sure that you have both high availability and scale. Your SQL servers may not be load balanced, probably not, but they will be in an availability set to also give you that high availability. So what that means is that this rack goes down, and everything else gets bigger. It means that this rack goes down, that virtual machine is now unreachable, load balancer picks up on it from the probe, and the other two take the rest of the traffic, and you've got that high availability from that. And this is all possible by putting them together in the same cloud service. Finally, the automated Azure-provided DNS, it means these two virtual machines that are in the same cloud service, they can now talk to each other, they can, just using DNS, say, hey, who's test VM2? They've not set up a DNS server, they've not had to mess with that or manage that, they just talk to the DNS server that we supply, and we'll be able to give you the IP address and you can create this connectivity. So let me quickly, oh, and one last thing. This is protected. So from bad guys trying to sneak in, they will not be able to figure out who test VM2 is. Great. Okay, let me show you this really fast. And then I will leave for time for some questions here. So here are my two Windows Server 2012 machines. All right, well, that's not what I wanted. Okay. So let's see here. I've got one machine up. And so let me click on cloud services to show you what we're looking at here. So these will now be listed here in cloud services, and I can click on this guy and see here. I have two instances in this cloud service, Windows Server 2012 VM1 and Windows Server 2012 VM2. I deployed them by connecting them as part of the provisioning step. And so one of the cool things that now I can do is, from Windows Server VM1, who's running right here, I can pull up my PowerShell. And I can do, again, just because it's got open connectivity, I can say, I don't remember the name now. I can say, okay, who's Windows Server? VM2. That's the other guy, right? Great. And so the ping does respond. So he is there. I can talk to him, right? So just to make sure, you know, who am I? Okay, I'm one. Great. So now I can also do quick connectivity here and say, okay, great, I'm connected in. Maybe this is my gateway that is the only thing that's got an external exposure. So now I can go just using DNS again, click in. Much faster since it's right nearby. And there you go, I can connect into this guy. And so he's now running, and of course I can from here ping back if I wanted to. It's not that interesting, but okay. I said I was gonna do it, so now I'm gonna do it. Okay. There we go. And so the ping does work back. Great. So that just shows you all the things that I didn't set anything up. I simply spun up two Windows Server 2012 VMs, and they can just talk to each other using DNS like this. So it's one of the more powerful things. We have a networking session, I think, later today that will talk quite a bit more detail on that. Okay. Excellent. So let me go back to the slides and just spend a couple more minutes. And then, let's see. Yeah, we can open it up for some questions. Oh, well, actually, we can open up for some questions right now, actually, and see if there's anything that you guys want to talk about. Yeah, go ahead.
Handling advanced security products, for instance, like a DLP, an IPS, a WAF. These are kind of concerns for us because. We were actually the keynote for AFLite trying to figure this stuff out.
Yeah, great. And, so don't answer poorly is what you're telling me.
Yeah. So it's a big part of that decision-making process is those security products become, kind of the key front doors. And we're just kind of curious on how you guys see that as a roadmap.
Yeah, great question. You know, I think when we look at I believe that we'll do a lot there. I think one of the biggest limitations we have right now is our networking architecture. We have single NICs, which is actually one of the things that a lot of security expectations will expect more than one NIC, simply to create sort of the DMZ-type solutions. So it's something that we are looking at. It's something that we're very aware of that being important to be able to set up a good security system, specifically on the front end. I think the platform, we feel good about the security system we have created, right? We feel good about the protections that we supply customers from other customers in the same zone. But I think that when you look at people connecting on premises, they're going to have expectations of a little bit more. And so that's where we are looking at things like supplying multiple NICs so that you can do things like that. So there's more work to do. We should talk more afterwards, I think. And I'd love to hear more exact details on what you're trying to do, and then we can talk better timelines. Yeah, definitely. You had a question. Yeah, go ahead. Great question. So the question was, do we have plans to integrate other applications like Exchange or Link? We are having those conversations. Link, actually, we have a limitation in the platform right now based on IP address. For Link to work, it requires lots of IP addresses to be able to point to the same sort of set of machines to do sort of conferencing and so on. It's something that we're working on, and we're working with the Link team on that. Exchange as well, we're talking with them. I'd love to hear more if you have a desire to run Exchange in this environment. I think the Office 365 solution is pretty powerful from the Exchange perspective. And so that's more of a conversation of how exciting is it for you to run something like Exchange in this environment. However, having said that, we will continue to expand the application portfolio. We started with what we considered the bare minimum requirements to launch. While we head towards GA and beyond, We will always add more applications, Microsoft and third-party applications, as we move forward. So that's always something that we're going to be building on and adding and expanding the platform. The question was, why did we start from SharePoint? We started from SharePoint, I think, because of the passion that we've heard around running SharePoint in Windows Azure. There's a lot of excitement over people being able to do it. I think Office 365 is a very powerful SharePoint environment, but it doesn't have FIZ support. It doesn't have for internet site support, which a lot of people are really interested in doing. And so when you really think of what we offer with SharePoint and Windows Azure, it's really sort of an on-premise version that you're leasing instead of buying, right? And so it allows you to do that much more granular control and deploy FIZ environments as well. Yeah, go ahead.
So because this is a 200-level session, I feel it's okay to ask a really dumb question. So
yeah, no, please,
dumbest question you're going to hear in the room.
No.
So I know some things about IaaS. What I don't get, though, is, so would you guys say up front, and I think you kind of said something like this, if I grabbed an Azure virtual machine,
yep,
and I put Exchange on it, would you come to my house and kill me, or is it...
Say last part of the question. Sorry.
Yeah, you made that an Exchange. If I made that an Exchange server,
yeah,
would you guys say this is a real dumb idea? Don't do that. Like, you know, come to my house and beat me up, or you know. Yeah. I guess what I'm asking is there some unspoken thing that the only thing we're supposed to put on Azure VMs is some web-based thing, you know, some end-tier system with IIS SQL, and that's about it? Is that what the thought is?
No, I think so. So your question was specifically about Exchange. So I'll answer both the specific and the general question, I think. So specifically about Exchange, you know, we don't, the Exchange team and Windows Azure do not support Exchange running in Windows Azure. Will it work? I don't know, right? We don't block it, right? So there's no sort of limitation that we say, well, you can't do that, right? There's no hard check in place. So there's nothing, because we just don't know. I mean, you're booting a VHD, right? There could be anything on it, right? So that's kind of one side of it. From more of a general point, you know, I don't think I'd say that it's just for web-based applications. I definitely wouldn't say that. I think that there's a lot of departmental applications, internal-facing applications that make a lot of sense. I think that it is important to make sure you are picking the right application to move. I think you want to be conscious of that. You shouldn't just assume, oh, my old hardware is dying, let me just move this app. I think you need to be conscious of what does this app need and will it work in this environment. Right? We are still commodity hardware under the hood. Right? It is still, you know, you can run SQL Server, but can you run SQL Server tier one beefy workloads? Probably not, right? It depends. It depends how beefy they are and in what ways they're beefy, right? So I think that it's a kind of a nuanced answer, but the point is I don't think you should say it's just web applications. That's not our goal. I think web applications and dev tests are the most obvious ways to get started, right? Dev tests is super easy because it is just a quick go and in and out, right? It's a great way to just feel it out and see how it works. But I think as we move forward, there's going to be a ton of real intense enterprise applications. Did I answer your question?
I guess I probably asked it badly. So if I went and bought some servers now and I put an application on it, I would worry about the operating system disks, I would worry about the data disks, whatever kind of shared storage there was, if indeed there was some, and I'd have some backup solution.
Yeah.
The backup solution would involve taking a lot of data off one machine to another machine, but I don't worry about that because their wire's already paid for.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking and what I'm missing altogether, and I'm really sorry about this, is that I've got a virtual machine running in the cloud.
Yep.
I don't know where I back it up to. If I back it up to something at home, I'm going to be beaten out of house and home for the amount of bandwidth to move that data across the web.
Yep.
And so is there something I'm missing? I don't think you guys guarantee that every drive is RAIDy and that sort of thing, and you've got backup somewhere. That's my job. That's not yours, right?
So I think, yeah, backup serves two purposes, right? One, it serves protection against hardware failures, right? And we do have an SLA according to the hardware failures that you can look up for Windows Azure Storage. You should have some confidence in our ability to not destroy the hardware because we have triplicate copies and we're constantly making sure that those things are moved and protected. The other point of backup, though, that's actually really important that we don't do is from user error, from application error, right, that the sort of the SQL Server's being written to, being modified by an admin and suddenly wiped out, right, that we don't protect against, right? So you still do want that backup solution. Now, if you're looking for a backup solution that's geo-protected as well, right, then you do have to think about, hey, where do I want to move it and where do I not want to move it, right? But from a pure just Windows Azure story, right, the data's there and it's triplicate copies, right? You can also copy it yourself in Windows Azure Storage and then you have six copies, right? So you can also do that backup local if you want to. We've seen a lot of different approaches to backup. We have seen backup back onto premises. We've seen backup from on-premises into the cloud. We've seen backup from one cloud to another, from our US West to our US East. We've seen backups from one cloud provider to another, right? From us to one of our competitors, right? Or from one of our competitors to us. So I think we've seen a lot of those different stories line up. I think from an application basis, the backup is still on you, right? So for SQL backups, you still want to use what you're comfortable with for SQL backups, right? But from a data and a disk perspective, right, it's on us. Does that make sense? Did I help?
Thank
yep.
You.
Any other questions? Go ahead. Let me start over again. No, just kidding.
See how it made our life easier yet.
Got it.
It almost feels like it's just fresh out of the oven. We haven't done the usability work yet. We haven't made it simpler yet.
Got it.
That's sort of.
Yeah. So the question/comment was it still didn't seem like it was that simple, right? It still didn't seem like it was that easy to use. I think that's great feedback. I think one of the things that we hope the solution will give is hopefully the portal is relatively easy to get going, right? So at least relatively easy to get started. And then the goal for sort of being able to enable other parts of your organization to use the system quickly, we do think hopefully the PowerShell scripts allow you to build out your solutions that then would make it really easy for anyone to just hit go on them, right? And so because of the provisioning system and the API solution, hopefully it's pretty easy to go share that out. Now, I grant you, there's more work to be done, I think, from perhaps a management perspective to make that really easy, right? Like a servicing perspective. We don't do automatic OS servicing. So there are still some aspects to that point that you're making that are really, really valid. And it would be great to talk with you more, actually, afterwards if you have some time to understand how you think we could improve to make that easier, because we are always improving. I think we'll be working for the next multiple years on this. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't speak to the details of our compliance story. We do have ISO compliance, which does have some coverage around sort of the rights and protections around what people can look at and what people can't look at and who can look at it and under what circumstances and so on. So it would be great for actually for an offline conversation, and I can point you to some of that documentation about sort of how that compliance works. We've got ISO now, and so that does protect us SSA 16 as well. So these are some of the compliance points that do protect you from that sort of abuse. Yeah. Great. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, great question. So the question was, do you have any controls over what's being written to and when it's flushed and how it's flushed when you're going to Windows Azure Storage and using the cache? The answer today is no. Those controls are managed by the host OS based on the resources it's got. It's something that we are looking at. I'd be interested to hear if that would be something that you'd be interested in doing. But yeah, right now we pretty much optimize based on the patterns of your workload that we're seeing, right, and sort of the way in which the system's looking all up. Great point. So it does decrease the transaction. The question was, does it buffer them or does it send out five transactions? It does decrease the transaction cost into storage, but the buffer size for writes is relatively small, so it probably won't be a substantial decrease. The read size will probably be a more reasonable decrease in cost. Correct. Yes. So if you have a lot of really, really small writes, it may help, which is what Windows is when it boots, which is why it really helps Windows. Yep. I would probably try it and get a feel for for sort of both cost-wise and speed and latency and so on, what you're seeing from that. So I think I have time for one more. It's flashing red, so it means I'm over. Go ahead, last question, and then I'll stick around as well. So if there's any additional questions that I missed here, I don't want to send you off angry.
Is there a way to move existing VHDs from a data center into Azure, and then how's that done?
Yeah, so there's a talk. Vijay, when's your talk? When is your talk? Wednesday, 1:30, he covers CS Upload, which is the tool that will allow you to just upload VHDs. So yes, you can take them from on-premises, you can take them from other data centers, other cloud providers, and you can just bring them up using that tool.
You don't support Server 2003, though?
We do not support Server 2003. We don't support 32-bit at all. That's important, actually. 32-bit will not boot on your way out. Just remember that. 32-bit will not boot. 64-bit Server 2003 we don't support. It may boot. I don't know.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, guys. Have a good day. Enjoy the rest of the sessions.